now we'll continue with another talk on Czech Cubism. Nick Sawicki speaking on how does it start modern art and the Frog Age.
Okay, actually, I hate to disappoint you, but no cubism. No cubism, pre-cubism. Okay, I'm going to stick with the same format that Ellie was using of actually projecting it here within the program, since we're still cutting off part of the image edge here. I want to first of all thank Matthew, Rose Carroll, Stephen, and the New York Public Library for the invitation to speak at today's session. This really is a wonderful opportunity, as we've seen, to talk about a variety of sites and moments in the history of Central European modernism. Can't seem to advance the slide. This is a forum that spans the Balkans, the Baltics, Germany, and the territory of Austria-Hungary, the interwar avant-gardes, and the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Above all, it promises to examine a defined set of issues and questions about the structures and institutions of Central European modernity, about the artistic and cultural responses they engendered, and whether the region's many modernist movements are at all commensurable, whether some critical or artistic bond really does bind Bucharest to Dresden, Prague to Warsaw, and late imperial art to the interwar avant-garde. One of the issues all of us are concerned with is whether we can make a set of claims about the region as a whole, about how modernism here developed, about the commonalities that link its individual modern movements, and about how modernism here was different from modernism in the west of Europe. It seems to me that this is one of the concerns underpinning this symposium and today's round of talks in particular. A popular premise of art historical scholarship since the late stages of the Cold War has been that modernism in Central Europe was distinctive because it emerged there by design as part of the region's long-term and programmatic national modernization campaigns. Starting in the late 19th century, these campaigns were led by national institutions like museums, art schools, theaters, patronage circles, which faulted their own cultures for being backward and provincial and for lacking modern attributes. They aspired to modernize culture, and at the same time, they hoped to endow the artistic production of their respective constituencies with distinctive national attributes, a national modernism, we might say, formulated as the exclusive estate of a single ethnic group. If we look to other common characteristics in the development of modernism in the region, we could also say that its other distinguishing feature was its richly uneven and episodic character, its ebb and flow, its lack of uniformity and predictability, and its hybrid and mutable nature. We might also note that modernism in Central Europe did not emerge solely from on high, as the official policy of established national institutions, but also bubbled up from the margins, from individual artists and groups working outside or even in opposition to their respective mainstream cultures. These individuals openly questioned the relevance of the artistic norms spread by their respective cultural institutions to their own modern life experiences, and they developed artistic and critical practices of their own. They were generally less interested in formulating overarching national or even local artistic programs, and far more concerned with redefining their own relationship to the modern world through art and making this relationship known to others. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the map of Central Europe flared up as they defined and expressed their modernist views, with a diverse array of public exhibitions, manifestos, ruptures, realignments, group formations, and critical debates. For examples, we could look to the early performances of the Green Balloon Cabaret in Krakow in 1905. We could look also to the first exhibitions of Egon Schiele and his circle in Vienna in 1909, or to the formation of Georg Lukács' Sunday Circle in Budapest on the cusp of the First World War. These episodes, too, were among the sites at which modernist ideals in Central Europe were formulated, with an exceptional urgency and force specific to the region. Although small-scale and ephemeral, these events and manifestations were endowed in their respective locales with an importance and visibility unheard of in a Western European city like Paris. They transpired within extraordinarily compact artistic communities, and often in conflict with institutionalized local and national artistic practices. In medium to large-sized cities like Prague, Zagreb, Budapest, even Krakow, the circle of artists and marketplace for art were disproportionately small. To orchestrate an exhibition or simply publish an artist statement could and often did send shockwaves through a city's entire artistic community. To put it another way, the qualities that we typically associate with provincial cities are what made this part of Europe the hotbed that it was: the compact scale of its respective artistic communities, and the consolidation of artistic norms and tastes by a few key institutions, which fomented resistance. These structural conditions set the stage in Central Europe for an uncommonly vibrant, explosive concentration of modernist debate and contest. I would like to focus in my talk today on one specific episode that took place in Prague in the early part of the 20th century. It marks an important site in the negotiation of modernism and also illustrates the point I just made about modernism's rise on the margins of mainstream national cultural practices. I will be looking at the public debut of the multi-ethnic group of Prague painters who called themselves Osma, or Die Acht, the Eight, at the first exhibition they staged in Prague in April and May of 1907. Now celebrating the 100-year anniversary of their exhibition, the group consisted of former students of Prague's Imperial Academy of Fine Arts, who in 1907 had just quit the school in frustration with its teaching and politics, which they found to be doctrinaire. None of the artists had exhibited before in Prague, and most were new arrivals to the city. They moved there from the provinces to study art, and came from a mix of Czech, Bohemian, German, Catholic, and Jewish families. The 1907 exhibition was their first. It lasted for no more than 5 weeks, but it shook the art world in Prague to its core. As the Prague poet Max Brod wrote in a review of the show, here was the start of a new and modern springtime for the city's art. Hardly any other episode before the First World War has been more frequently cited as a watershed moment in the history of modernism in Prague and the Czech lands. In the words of one art historian, the Prague School of Modern Painting, as of this very moment, was born. I will hope this afternoon to look more critically at how this particular event of 1907 was constituted and how the modernism of the Eight was here delineated by the Eight artists as a group and by the public that viewed their work. The group that the Eight formed took its name from the number of participants in the first 1907 exhibition. It had no membership policies or formal structure, and its composition changed over the years. Five of the artists were native speakers of Czech and came from Czech Catholic families. These included Emil Fila, shown in the above painted self-portrait from 1906, and the artists Antonín Procházka, Emil Pitterman, Otakar Kubín, and Bohumil Kubišta, who was the focus of Eleanor's talk. He appears in this photograph on your right, just next to Emil Fila's self-portrait. Two of the Eight artists came from primarily German-speaking families and were of Jewish faith, Max Horb and Friedrich Feigl, who appears here in the photograph on the left. One of the artists, Willy Novák, came from a mixed Czech and German Christian family. All of the Eight were born in the early to mid-1880s, and with the exception of Feigl, who was born in Prague, they were all raised in lower middle and middle class provincial households in Bohemia and Moravia. They were part of a large wave of incoming provincial students who flooded Prague's universities in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. They moved to Prague between 1900 and 1905 to pursue a higher education in art, and they enrolled there at the state-run Prague Academy of Fine Arts. The school itself was one of only three accredited state art academies in Austria, and in the last two decades, in the face of state control and in the face of Prague's ethnically diverse population, it had also transformed itself into an almost exclusively Czech and Slavic institution. The school had traditionally been populated by Bohemian German faculty and students, But by 1901, all of its faculty members were Czech or Slavic. That year, from a total of 78 pupils, there were only 6 Germans and 1 Jewish student. Once enrolled, nearly all of the 8 started their studies with the same teacher, a Croatian graduate of the Ecole in Paris, who was named Vlaho Bukovac. He appears in this photograph on the right in the studio at the Academy. Bukovac himself was a student in Paris of the French realist Alexandre Cabanel, and he ran the Prague Academy's 2-year foundation course in painting. It was here that the 8 began their studies. The course consisted of 35 hours a week of studio time and separate sessions in drawing, anatomy, perspective, style, and art history. Several of the other faculty were trained in France, and together they instructed their students in a French-derived academic realist style of portraiture. By the last quarter of the 19th century, this had become the official mode of painting at the Prague Academy. It was introduced at the Academy as a proprietary Czech style, a modern and Czech national style of painting. Modern because it abandoned historical motifs and styles in favor of contemporary day bourgeois subjects. Czech because it was introduced by Czech, or at the very least Slavic artists, to replace an earlier neoclassical academic style that many Czechs viewed as a German import, an unpleasant reminder of an earlier period of German cultural and political hegemony. Brought over to Prague from Paris and adapted to local tastes, academic realism became the chosen style of Prague's new Czech upper middle class elite, and also the favorite style of the city's largely Czech municipal government and politicians. It persisted as the dominant mode of painting at the Academy until after the First World War. And from early on in their studies, the 8 were disenchanted with their academic education. They chafed at its limited roster of bourgeois urban subjects, at its expectation for detailed and lifelike rendering, and at the exhaustive demands it placed on the artist to follow indoctrinated artistic techniques. As a reprieve from their studies, they began to produce independent work outside the classroom. Working on their own time, they produced quickly executed sketches and paintings from life, rendered in pencil, crayon, and oils, which deviated from the norms and techniques of academic art. These pictures were crafted without the protracted sessions typical of an academic work, and they were reductive in their treatment of color, form, and depth. They lacked naturalistic fidelity, and they focused on a new roster of subjects and motifs, previously unknown to Prague. Scenes and figures from the provincial locales in which the 8 were raised, pictures from their travels, and paintings of friends from within their circle. This gave the 8 an arena for experimentation beyond the academic program. It also provided them with a common point of convergence. When they met at the Academy between 1900 and 1905, they recognized in one another a common resistance to the school's institutionalized norms of painting and to the idea of artistic indoctrination in general. They desired to work on their own terms, to choose and develop their own forms and subjects, and to set their own criteria for what constituted a successful work of art. This very basic, rather uncomplicated notion of individual artistic freedom was by this time already well established in the discourse on modern art in Europe, and it defined the modernism of the 8, a modernism that was posited in explicit contradistinction to the institutionalization of artistic practice. This was the bond around which the friendships of the 8 formed, and it was a significant enough tie that it gave the 8 cause to think of themselves as a group entity, and this despite their own diverse Czech, German, and Jewish backgrounds. Historically, artists of these 3 ethnicities in Prague did not traditionally mix. They did not convene together or work together, and often they were divided by a hostile politics, particularly Czechs and Germans. This was another attribute of the modernism of the 8, that the group did not establish itself as a single ethnic bloc, but encompassed artists of varied backgrounds. There was, in fact, no precedent in Prague for an elective heterogeneous structure such as this, which voluntarily bridged the gap that divided the city's 3 major ethnic populations. These attributes of the group would be placed directly on display when the 8 chose to make their art and their distinctive group formation public. By late in 1906, this was already an idea that the 8 were entertaining. Several of the artists had recently quit the Academy, ending their studies prematurely, and by early 1907, preparations for a group show had begun in earnest, largely taken up by Emil Fila, Friedrich Feigl on your left, and Bohumil Kubista on the right. These three men searched for a space to hold their show, and after several unsuccessful attempts soliciting the few galleries and exhibiting halls then operating in Prague, they rented a ground floor space in a newly built building on the border of the city's old and new towns, near the Jewish quarter. Max Brod, who was a close friend and a next-door neighbor of Feigl, remembered the space as a vacant shop, still smelling of plaster. The building itself was three doors down from the recently finished Art Nouveau Hotel Paris in Prague, shown above, and right next door to a popular Jewish credit union. The street was busy and had considerable foot traffic, and a poster, which does not survive, hung outside the space. The catalog, which you see above on the right, was a one-sided leaflet with no illustrations. Printed in bold type across the top was the digit 8, with the word exhibition written in both Czech and German. No descriptions, titles, or dates were provided, and no prices were given in this leaflet. Exactly what works were shown remains something of a mystery, and the clearest account of the exhibited pictures comes from a review of the show published under the title Spring in Prague, written by Feigl's friend Max Brod. The article ran in the Berlin journal Die Gegenwart, where Brod was a contributor, on May 18, 1907. We know from Brod's review that landscapes, portraits, and autobiographical scenes from the everyday lives of the eight and their friends and families predominated. The works were produced in the prior year or two, either outside the confines of the academy or after the artists had quit the school. Bohumil Kubista exhibited work from recent time he had spent in Florence after quitting the Prague Academy. As Max Brod wrote, beautiful pastels, a striking military painting, and a wonderful self-portrait in pen and ink. The self-portrait by Kubista survives and dates to 1906. You see it on your left. At 1.5 meters tall, it shows the artist in a standing position, in a black jacket and purple necktie. Kubista's body and face are turned to the right, and his eyes are fixed forward, apprehending the viewer. A copy of Emile Zola's novel Nana occupies the table at the center of the room, perhaps signaling Kubista's appreciation for Zola's socialist convictions or his visible role as a promoter of modern art in Paris. On the wall, in the right-hand upper corner, hangs an unframed landscape painted in a very loose, impressionistic manner that competes with Kubista's own pen and ink execution, which is far more tighter and more controlled. On the left side of the wall is a small reproduction of a Rembrandt self-portrait from the Uffizi Gallery. Another exhibited work was a canvas by Max Horb, on your right, painted by the artist during a trip that he took to Munich after he left the Prague Academy. In his review of the show, Max Brod described the subject as a square in Munich, flooded with sunlight. This is more than a customary, strictly naturalistic sun, he wrote, more than verity of color and observation. It is a hymn to sunlight, a new sun, a celebration and salutation of the sun. So exquisitely and incorrectly is it painted, and so imperfectly. Across the painting surface in the lower two-thirds of the composition, Horb deploys a pale yellow pigment in visible diagonal strokes that suggest the passage of rays of light onto the paving and street. The paint is thickly applied, and the shadows cast by the figures passing through the square indicate the orientation of the sunlight, which seems to emanate from a point outside the canvas, near its lower left corner. Vili Novak showed a painting of a vegetable garden after the rain, in which he adapted to his own work the painterly techniques and palette of Van Gogh and Paul Gauguin. Here, as Max Brod wrote in his review, quote, turbid, nourishing air breathes out of the thick greenery. Wet clouds hurtle over the fading hills behind, entwining themselves in the heavy and rainy treetops, and a man in the center treads assertively into a grimly refreshed nature. In another painting from the exhibition, Novak and his mother and brother are shown seated on the veranda of their middle-class provincial home after the late summer's harvest, a picture that Max Brod described as, quote, unearthly. There was also a painting at the exhibition by Emil Fila, shown here on the right in black and white. Brod described it as a scene of, quote, a villa with smooth red tiles by a pond, with clear autumn air rippling from the open sky in a corner of the painting. The artist Ottokar Kubin exhibited a picture that Brod described as, quote, a garden in early spring. A slatted fence glistens with wet, dark violet hues, Wetness accumulates around the wistful branches, around the trunk of a birch, and a cool mist drifts over the background. The remaining works from the exhibition are more difficult to identify, since the descriptions provided are less detailed or do not correspond to extant works. Feigl, according to Max Brod, showed a painting of a dam on the river in Prague. There was also another painting by Kubin, a portrait that Brod compared to the artist's garden scene with fence and birches. The face in this portrait, he wrote, was painted, quote, like the terrain, with deep red furrows and pores like earth. The paint is applied thickly. Often, Brod wrote, it is handled like a sculptural material. A second group exhibition followed in June and July of 1908, exactly a year later. It introduced another selection of work and two new artists, Vincent Benesch, a fellow dropout from the Prague Academy, and Linka Šajtaurova, a woman and herself a student at the Prague School of Applied Arts. Benesch's portrait of a friend, shown at the second exhibition of the eight, appears on your left. Also displayed at the exhibition was Šajtaurova's still life on the right, dating to early 1908. And when we look at these paintings, to speak of a common style in all of these works would be difficult. Each of the participants in the debut exhibition of the eight and in the second show of 1908 deployed and adapted in their paintings different practices and techniques. For Max Brod, the most significant point of artistic convergence was the feature that he identified as the, quote, common agenda of the eight. The fact that the artists themselves did not work in a, quote, strictly naturalistic fashion, but instead presented in their pictures, quote, more than the verity of color and observation, as Brod noted in his comments on Max Forbes' Cityscape from Munich. By the customary academic standards of the day, as Brod commented, the eight were indeed painting incorrectly and imperfectly. For Brod, this modernism was posited in opposition to the usual naturalistic aspirations of realist painting and its attendant techniques, and the pictures themselves clearly foreground this break and rupture. In the exhibited paintings of the eight, there is a near-complete absence of academic devices. There is relatively little attention paid to the representation of detail. There's little line used to separate individual spatial fields, and little perspective or modeling to affect the illusion of three dimensions. The customary academic aspiration for rendering a convincingly lifelike representation of one subject is minimized. These works openly signal the differentiation of the eight from the monolithic realist style in which they were instructed at the Prague Academy, and they also signal the rupture of the artists from their teachers and from more conservative classmates. The diversity of these paintings is also underpinned by a manifestly diverse group composition, and Brod recognized this right away. In his review published during the exhibition, he described the multi-ethnic structure of the eight as an important element of their modernism, as another conspicuous feature that set the eight apart from other groups of artists in Prague. "Springtime, springtime," Brod wrote. "Germans and Czechs have gathered, eight artists without regard for their nationality. Here in Prague, the epicenter of political struggles, where even a bowling club or lyric ensemble convenes under the shadow of national colored banners." To anyone who is not from Prague, it is difficult to convey the comical and delicate nuances of our linguistically stratified society, which so eagerly cultivates its talent for accentuating only those things that divide the two tribes and never what they have in common. To the contrary, at the risk of offending some patriots on both sides, I would like to assert, writes Brod, that in Prague it is difficult to speak of a purely German or purely Czech nation, only of Praguers. Max Brod, as a Prague Jew, makes reference here only to Germans and Czechs, and he notably passes over the possibility that a third Jewish nation might exist alongside the linguistically stratified and often mutually hostile German and Czech Prague communities. The real complexity of this issue would only become evident to him in later years, after he began to come to terms with Zionism. Yet he recognized in the debut of the eight a distinctive group of painters and a landmark episode nonetheless, distinctive for the diversity of its art and the diversity of its participating member artists, several of whom he knew personally. Those aspects that, Those aspects that Broad singled out as positive and emblematic elements of the group's modernism, other Prague critics openly criticized. Max Broad's review, in fact, was the only published account of the debut exhibition of the Eight to provide such a positive characterization of the group and its art. The Bohemian German and Jewish press in Prague made not a single mention of either exhibition, despite the fact that three of the artists were native speakers of German and two were Jewish. The Czech language press, outraged at the fact that two such exhibitions had been organized, responded with direct attacks. Between the spring of 1907 and the summer of 1908, more than a dozen negative, often scathing reviews were published of the Eight and their work in the Czech press. And the ringleader for this campaign was the Czech art critic František Harlas, a generation older than the Eight. He was a former student of the Prague Academy himself and had studied painting at the Prague School when its academic realist style was introduced. Writing for the Czech literary and cultural journal Osvěta, Harlas criticized the Eight for the seemingly roughshod handling of their pictures, which broke with academic norms of painting, referring to Otakar Kubin's lost portrait, which Broad had hailed for its pigment applied thickly. František Harlas saw, quote, unmixed blotches of paint, Prussian blue, chrome oxide green, alizarin, chrome yellow and white, all variously intersected and arranged. Something like a human form, he wrote, but you can't even recognize a trace of modeling. Harlas accused the Eight of staging with their exhibition a public secession, as he called it, from the Academy of Fine Arts, and he compared them to the instigators of the 1905 Russian Revolution, barbarians at the gate of polite middle-class Prague society. Harlas also accused the Eight of aping foreign styles of painting imported from the West. He called them, quote, minions of Van Gogh, Gauguin, and Edvard Munch. And he criticized them for failing to take up a, quote, Czech style in their art. Finally, Harlas compared the Eight to the fictionalized character Matej Brouček, a self-absorbed petit bourgeois anti-hero who is the central character in a series of satirical tales by the writer Svatopluk Čech, The Travels of Mr. Brouček. The most popular of the Brouček stories follows the protagonist, Mr. Brouček, as he is transported back in time from present-day Prague to the 15th century Hussite Wars. There, Brouček finds himself alongside the Czech Hussites as they struggle to defend their nation from attack by German anti-Hussite crusaders. During the thick of conflict, he famously deserts his countrymen in order to save his own hide and returns to the modern world, putting on his modern 19th century costume. For Harlas, the artists of the Eight, like the fictionalized Mr. Brouček, are portrayed as unreliable supporters of the Czech nation. According to Harlas, they look to faraway cultures and artistic models for their art, rather than cleaving closer to home or taking it upon themselves to develop a legibly, quote, Czech style of art, as Harlas argued it was important to do. A nearby exhibition of the still-living 19th-century Czech history painter Mikuláš Aleš provided Harlas with a foil, and it left him to brood in his writing over the enormous fissure between the two bodies of work. Aleš's paintings generally dwelled on historic and religious themes, close to the hearts of Czech revivalists, and his style meshed linearity and contour with localized passages of illusionism. Harlas, for his part, described Aleš's paintings as a prime example of how present-day art in Prague could be made more Czech, not with a return to academic realism or an embrace of the modern practices of the Eight, but as a deliberate antidote to modernism. Harlas wrote the following. I do not know how Aleš's work suits that whole modernist Czechness of the latest fashion, but certainly it is Czech, much more Czech than all that tired rubbish from elsewhere. I am always happy, he said, when I hear Aleš's work praised, as he is so non-modern through and through. Here in the writing of one of Prague's most vocal proponents of academic realism in a review that contrasts the work of the Eight and an older painter whose artistic identity is closely linked with the Czech National Revival, the terms modern and Czech are positioned as irreconcilable. Modern art is portrayed by Harlas as hostile to all things Czech, and it is characterized also as having its origin in foreign lands and cultures. Rubbish imported from elsewhere, as he writes, by a gang of painters for whom the Czech nation and its traditions hold no redeeming value or interest. If there was to be any hope for the future of Prague's art, Hadlas claimed, artists would have to follow Alice's own, quote, non-modern tendency of developing outwardly Czech subjects and motifs. Where the exhibition of the Eight gave Max Brod cause for great celebration and cause to speak of a new Prague spring of modernism, for Hadlas it provoked anxiety, particularly about what the future of, quote, Czech art would hold. What a painful sight, he wrote in his comments on the Eight. What despair and regret meets the viewer of these garish and crudely handled paintings? Is this where modern art is headed? And Czech painting, too. Is it from these people that your workers will come? The answer, of course, was for Hadlas relatively simple, all presented in the sharp relief of black and white. Czech cultural work, as Hadlas and many others envisioned it, could and would not be carried out by the Eight, because of the group's mixed composition and because of the diverse body of art that the Eight produced, which resisted notions of a single and legibly Czech artistic form or subject matter. At this particular moment in time, modernism did not coexist easily with stock conventions of nation and nationality, and this was not an issue peculiar only to Prague. It was indeed a matter that artists and critics throughout Central Europe before the First World War routinely tackled, and well into the interwar years. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Nick. Questions?
Yeah, it's sort of an interesting thing because in a lot of this rhetoric and discourse, certain figures begin to emerge as stereotypes and to embody certain tendency that they don't necessarily themselves embody in their work. Alice, Naomi is bringing up the fact that later on in the 19-teens and particularly closer to the war, a lot of the Eight artists who later affiliate themselves with a group called Skupina Vytvarnych Umělců, which Ellie was talking about earlier, a lot of them actually become very interested in Alice's work precisely for these points at which his style resists realism and resists illusionism. There are some, I mentioned, localized passages of illusionism and naturalism in Alice's work, but a lot of that linearity really speaks to them. In a way, I think that, you know, the work that they did later on in publishing woodcuts and paintings on glass, which you've talked about in your work, really appeals to them. It's sort of an interesting thing when you begin to consider what kinds of sources these artists were looking at, and I think that whole discussion of the exchange between Kubista and Kirchner is really fascinating for that reason. But what many of the artists of the Eight, particularly at this moment in 1907 and 1908, were doing was already kind of looking at very diverse sources, and Alice, you know, as I said, by the early teens becomes, you know, a very interesting figure, both politically and artistically. So I don't know if that answers the
question.
Just a brief comment.
Yeah.
Basically, the whole Alice issue was a little bit earlier than it was already in more or less nearly redirection.
Yeah.
The Manes sort of revisited Alice's work from the point of view of drawings. They wanted basically to reference the open form as something what was not emphasized before, what had been not emphasized before.
Right.
And so that the different kind of Alice appeared at the beginning of the section.
Yeah.
That's one thing. And the second thing is, I think that at least Schauder appreciated the work of the Eight, primarily Kubista and Fuller. There was a heavy discussion on which he commented in Novinar, you know, and he definitely was a protector. Not that he would really write criticism, because there was a time when he left the art journal and moved on back to literature, and there obviously was a policy on his personal position, but But there was appreciation at that group because Chagha had a big influence on many people.
Yeah.
So Harwas is a good example for such a group. It's very bold.
Yeah.
However, the Osvieta journal and the whole circle was already since the
mid-1890s, yeah.
Since the 90s, considered to be a voice of its own.
Yes.
Kind of peculiar quality, you know. Yeah. So the campaign was not unusual.
Those are all very interesting comments. I mean, I'm dealing particularly with this very tight moment, the span of a year. There are moments at which more criticism appears. One of the things that I found really interesting in the research was, as I mentioned before, both the absence of German language and Jewish press coverage of this show, which transpires actually physically in Prague on the borders of a German, Jewish, and Czech neighborhood. There's almost no commentary, and the reviews in the Czech press, of which I've counted more than a dozen, are all, they range from just mildly scathing to outright attacks like this. And it points for me, I think it comes out sort of in the images as well, to a particular kind of crisis of identity that's taking place within the mainstream institutions. And I count Osvieta, that journal, already as a kind of institution of its own by this point. So it's a very interesting dilemma. Dan also mentioned the Czech poet and critic František Šalda as a patron and supporter of this group. And one of the things I haven't, because of time, had a chance to talk about is what kind of economic patronage there was at this point. Šalda actually purchased a few paintings. A few others were given to him. Max Brod purchased 5 paintings at the first exhibition, and a small circle of supporters actually began to gather, although this support didn't manifest itself in public criticism or in debate in the press. It was rather kind of quiet affair. The works were circulated and bought by friends, and the exhibition itself was actually visited more, one could say, by contemporaries of the artists than by the Prague public that would have typically gone to exhibitions. So all really interesting points.
And you had started to touch on my question. You had said that the works displayed were not specifically known, that there is a number of pieces by specific artists. What was the disposition of the pieces? They were for sale, and you mentioned that some of them were acquired, but there's one, I realize it's problematic not knowing which piece.
The 7, I think, paintings that I showed were all exhibited at the 2 exhibitions. So based on Max Brod's criticism and these very detailed passages that he gives about the paintings, one can actually begin to gradually reconstruct this. These are the only paintings that I could say with certainty that they were exhibited, and some scholars concur with that, others do not. But the disposition of the other works is rather difficult to tell. For instance, the balance of sketches to paintings. We know that marvelous, really tall pen and ink self-portrait by Kubista was shown. Probably there were also pastels and drawings that were shown alongside the paintings. Yeah.
I'm thinking more of the commercial success or
okay.
Failure.
Yeah.
What sold, how much sold, who bought it?
Well, Brod, in his autobiography, and this is sort of a retrospective account by him, states that he purchased 5 paintings at the first show. There were also a couple of purchases by Šalda, the Czech critic and poet, and a couple of purchases by immediate friends of the 8, fellow classmates, mostly from their secondary school years. It was really a relatively successful exhibition in that respect, if one considers that 8 or 9 works, there were a total of 60 works at this exhibition, that 8 or 9 works sold. For Prague, this was actually a fairly big coup. They didn't most likely didn't sell for very large prices, something under 100 crowns, closer usually to 50. So the direct economic benefit really wasn't there, but in terms of an inaugural exhibition staged independently by a group of artists, in a venue not traditionally known for art, in a storefront in a newly developing part of Prague. This was a pretty big success, and it did really resonate in the Prague art world through this criticism that was published and through the kind of cafe discussions that took place among this circle. So it is an event that really did resonate to a much greater degree than could have been even expected at this point. In fact, some of the artists were actually taken aback and surprised by some of the reactions that were there.
More questions? Yes.
Yes, I have a comment and a question. The comment is that both the academic paintings that were exhibited in Prague, like the one you showed on the International Center of
yes.
Art,
yeah.
and the ones made by the Aid, were informed by French painting styles.
Sure.
The academic painting style, and then the Impressionist and Fauve and so on. And that doesn't appear in the criticism of
Hadlas.
So he's only commenting on the fact that these eight, the new painters, are imitators of Western style, but he's not acknowledging the genealogy of the academic Czech painting. It's as if that's invisible, right? Because the content there is somehow Czech, which is kind of interesting. I wonder if that came up in any of the criticism.
Yeah, it's a great comment. In fact, Hadlas, I think I mentioned this in the paper, calls he calls them minions of Van Gogh and Gauguin and Munch. So, you know, whether you take Van Gogh to be a French painter, I certainly do at this moment because he's been by this point in discourse made, if not French, then at least Parisian. That debate is already beginning to surface, and these charges of aping and emulating foreign styles do mount, and they continue into the early teens. In fact, the work that Naomi's done on this would show that as you get nearer to the war, these questions intensify, and the accusations do as well. And as far as that, the kind of unproblematic view of the academic realist style that's propagated within the academy, that institution very quickly and seamlessly nationalizes and naturalizes realism as Czech and Slavic. There is a kind of parallel discourse that's going on here at the same time about how realism is not only Czech but Slavic in general. This filters in through the activity of the wanderers in Russia, who are now beginning to be seen in Czech discourse as realists of a sort and critical realists, although that's certainly not what's happening in the academic work that I've shown. But it is a very unproblematic look that not only the critics but the artists have with respect to academic realism. It comes in at a time when the academy itself, in terms of its student and faculty population, is becoming Czech, and it serves them as a kind of tool or device to displace, forcibly displace, not only neoclassicism but German faculty members, German-speaking faculty members. So there's a lot more that that could be said about that. I think it's a fascinating matter. Yeah.
You mentioned that the Jewish and German press just ignored this whole development, but of course you also quoted a link from Max Brod.
Yeah. It was published in the Imperial German journal Die Gegenwart, which was published at the time in Berlin.
Either German or Jewish or both?
I was thinking about Prague, sort of the Prague German press and the Prague Jewish press.
Because this appeared actually in Berlin.
Yeah, the Brod's article appeared in Berlin. There was almost no mention made of it in Prague, although certain individuals in Prague, certainly in Broad Circle, subscribed to the journal Die Gegenwart. Kafka was one of them. He was an avid reader of the journal, as was that whole Prague circle. So I was speaking mostly about just the reaction in Prague, where there were several German language and Jewish journals were publishing both in German and in Czech, that devoted part of their coverage to art and exhibitions. And this show either went unnoticed or was purposely shunted to the side. But yeah, it's quite interesting. Yeah.